power poles a thorn in your side? Had double and triple poles in your neighborhood for years? Tired of staring at them? Well, we sat down with Hawaiian Electric to understand what's involved in a recent agreement between the power company and Hawaiian Tel. Here's HECO's Peter Rozek.
We had 120,000 joint poles across the islands, and everything but Kauai. Kauai, of course, is a separate utility and a separate arrangement. And it was getting increasingly complicated when this joint pole agreement started. There were telephone lines and there were electric lines, and they were pretty simple. Now there are cable lines and other kinds of communications lines, and there are streetlights on some poles and so forth. It's gotten very complicated, and you never really knew, is this a Hawaiian Electric pole, a Hawaiian Telecom pole, or a jointly owned pole? And, you know, in the media, they'd report an accident, somebody hit a pole, and they'd call up and say, you know, somebody hit your pole, and we'd look at that. We'd have to go look it up in the book, and then they said, no, that's not our pole. So considerable time we've been negotiating with that. We have a joint pole committee. So, you know, it's an ongoing thing. But we started negotiating seriously a little over a year ago, I think, and finally reached this agreement where they're going to give up their ownership in these poles. They're going to become renters on the poles. Nothing's going to move right away, but their lines and so forth will be renters on the poles that we own and we are responsible for. And that's going to, we believe, it's going to make things a lot simpler for the public. It's going to allow technology like 5G and that kind of thing to come in. It's going to let the telephone company concentrate on the communications that they really want to focus on, which is not primarily landlines, after all. And it will allow us to streamline the process and to eventually, you know, have a source of income that we can use to offset the bills of all our customers. So, you know, in the end, it's a good deal, and it's going to reap results. It's not going to be overnight. Nothing's going to move tomorrow. And we've given ourselves a 10-year window to get rid of what we call the double poles. And those are where you see one tall, fairly new pole, and next to it is a stub, which still has some wires on it, because we moved our equipment onto the new pole, but the other companies who were responsible were not ready to move their stuff, and so we would cut off the top, and it sits there. And frankly, some of them have sat there for a very long time.
So for auntie and uncle in my neighborhood who have been looking at three poles for God knows how long.
Auntie, I'm sorry. Yeah. What we're doing now is we're doing a count of these 14,000 poles to really establish how many there are, where they are, and so forth. And we're going to look to see whether the pole is damaged, and that's going to give it a priority. We're going to want to get the dangerous stuff out of the way first. And then we're going to look at how and what the oldest poles. And we're also going to, you know, probably look at trying to do it by neighborhood rather than trying to, you know, do a Waianae pole today and a Kahala pole tomorrow. So we're going to come up with a plan that's going to get us to 14,000 of these poles removed within less than 10 years. And I think it'll start off kind of slowly and it'll pick up. Obviously, if we have to use the crews for more immediate problems, we're going to have to pull them back. But we're going to have when we need to retrain some of our lines people, our crews, to deal with them.
So you're trying to do this strategically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the idea is not to spend more money. The idea is to spend as little as possible to get this cleaned up. And we know, everybody who's got one of those things in their neighborhood or in front of their house hates it. You know, we don't like it. It's not. Doesn't help anything at all. So we're eager to get those out of the way.
Okay, but there's also then the other component, because like you said, you've got maybe city or state lights on these poles. And I think the thinking back way back when was that last man standing, right? If your stuff is on the pole, then you have to remove the pole.
That's right. And that was because we had a joint agreement and, you know, we couldn't, we didn't have the ability to move somebody else's stuff, in essence. So now we're going to be the sole owners and sole managers of these poles. And eventually, you know, we still may have to call the phone company if it's a complex wiring or something like that. But eventually, our crews are going to have the ability to do the routine kind of movements. and we will then be responsible instead of last man standing or is this your poll or our poll or when did it win? You know, the we're going to eliminate this kind of constant wrangling, you know, not ill feeling, but just, you know, is this your job or our job? And it's our job now, and we're going to do it. And this will allow us to concentrate on what we want to do and them to concentrate on their business.
So I think maybe folks may not realize that there was a poll committee that used to meet, I don't know if it was quarterly, but...
You know, the joke is it's not the Czechoslovakia, it's the poll. No, it's the, you know, there is a joint poll committee and they meet. And, you know, even if they don't meet, they all know who they are and they email. And, you know, nobody has meetings anymore that amount to much, as you know. So, you know, the people in our company, people in their company who are in that area talk to each other constantly and had meetings periodically, and you know, where they could look at bigger issues. And you know, that was a big drain. If we could have just said, you know, we'll take care of it, that would have been great. But we had to, you know, we had to work as a team in a joint agreement. So we're going to eliminate that. There still will be, I think, about 20,000 Hawaiian Telecom solely owned poles across the islands. And we have about 50,000 solely owned poles. So now we are responsible for roughly 170,000 poles, ours entirely. They're still responsible for the 20,000. The city and county and the state have some rentals, and we're trying to get an agreement with them. Same thing. They don't want to be in the pole business. They want to be in, they're in the streetlight business and or the traffic signal business. And it would make their life much simpler if they were just responsible for the physical lights and didn't have to worry about the wiring. And when the pole got knocked over, somebody else came and replaced the pole for them. So we think we're going to have an agreement with them, you know, sooner or later. As I said, it's incredibly more complicated, you know, bookkeeping and lawyers and all the rest. But at the end of the day, it's a fairly straightforward kind of thing where we're going to be, from now on, you know, the odds are overwhelming that if you see a pole problem, you call Hawaiian Electric and you say, we can say, yeah, we'll take care of it as soon as it fits into our schedule. Right. Or if it's a danger, that's the other thing, you know, we can move much more quickly. If there's a dangerous situation with a pole, we don't have to go back to the book and try to figure out whose it is or who touched it last or whatever.
But health and safety, number one.
Right. I mean, safety of our customers, safety of our crews, just in general, is always our primary consideration. So we think it'll be safer. We think it'll be faster, getting outages restored sooner. And, you know, it'll take a little time to rev up, but it's going to be a good thing all around.
Okay, so be patient. Maybe sometime next year.
No, don't say that. You know, because some people, if we talk about 10 years, some people are going to be next year. Some people are going to be 5 years from now. There's no getting around the fact that, you know, we can't do them all. And 14,000 is a lot of these things. You probably, you know, realize when you're looking at the one in front of your house, that's the only one you care about. But we have to look at the whole island system, and we have to keep the whole system going simultaneously with dealing with this, basically an aesthetic issue.
Is there anything that's unique to any of the other islands?
Not really. I think on Maui, we also have some responsibilities for streetlights, not the county. You know, each of these agreements grew up separately because they were separate companies back in the day, and Mutual Telephone was universal. So each agreement, you know, just like each island is different in that respect. But in general, it's the same kind of thing. We had joint polls and we had questions of responsibility. So this will work, you know, work these kinds of frustrations out of the system, we think, and everything will be, smoother, not faster, but, you know, in the long haul, we'll get those 14,000 poles out of people's neighborhoods, and everybody will forget what a double pole looks like.
Okay, you know? Or a triple pole. All right.
Or a triple pole.
And that was a conversation we had with Hawaiian Electric's Peter Razak yesterday. It was about a deal reached between Hawaiian Telecom and HECO over pole ownership and a long-running frustration for residents over the time it takes to remove the old utility poles. The deal was approved by the Public Utilities Commission earlier this month.
Hello, my name is Lynn Babington. I'm the president of Chaminade University of Honolulu, and we are underwriters of HPR. While we are increasingly becoming a global society, there are significant changes happening here, and this demands an objective, invested organization like Hawaii Public Radio. I feel Chaminade and HPR have similar goals. Simply put, we're working to create a better Hawaii, and what could be better than that?
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's backyard quiz has us delving in our dramatic arts history, specifically the world of opera. There is an old playbill in the Hawaii State Archives that tells us that one of the earliest shows was a performance of Donizetti's The Daughter of the Regiment on February 11th, 1854, in the Variety Theater. The royal family of the Kingdom of Hawaii was reported to enjoy opera and attend productions in Honolulu. Over a century later, in 1960, the island's Hawaii Opera Theater was established. For today's quiz, can you name the first hot production, and bonus points if you know where it was staged? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Ken Rubin from Geology and Geophysics at the University of Hawaii Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
No true Hawaiian will evade it. That was the headline of a two-page newspaper ad penned by Queen Liliuokalani and Prince Jonah Kuhio Kalani Aniole in 1914. They were encouraging residents of territorial Hawaii to donate to the Red Cross following America's entry into World War I. Despite being annexed by the United States only 19 years earlier, people in Hawaii embraced the war effort. Thousands volunteered for service in the military and on the home front. Queen Liliuokalani led a territory-wide drive to knit wool socks and bandages. The largest mobilization of the Hawaii National Guard in history was also called. By the end of fighting in 1918, more than 100 people from Hawaii had been killed in the Great War. Shooting stopped on November 11, 1918, on what became known as Armistice Day and is now Veterans Day in the U.S. This Sunday is the 100th anniversary of the World War I armistice, and commemorations of that truce are being held across the nation. Hawaii celebration will be taking place at the War Memorial Auditorium in Waikiki. Ahead of that ceremony, a 100th anniversary plaque was unveiled. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was there and spoke with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Curtis Manny Manchester. He was part of the Hawaii World War I Centennial Task Force and shared some of Hawaii's little-known history in the Great War.
It's really one of the untold, unknown stories of the war, although there's a book on it by Dr. Kuykendall that people can look up. We had almost 10,000 soldiers, sailors, and Marines from Hawaii that served in the First World War. Six of the first casualties in the war were aboard the SS Aztec, and they were from Hawaii. It was torpedoed by a Imperial German Navy U-boat off the coast of France delivering supplies to the war effort there. So our experience started very early. There were German Imperial Navy ships that were interned here in Hawaii, and German sailors were held prisoner here. There was believed to have been possibly a little bit of espionage activity here, which is interesting. And it's also part of a war where, you know, our allies were a little different from World War II. For example, the coasts and harbors of Hawaii were protected by the Imperial Japanese Navy, which was one of our allies, while the U.S. Navy sent many of its ships to the Atlantic Ocean. So it's very important to remember that. Citizens of Hawaii as individuals made huge efforts in the war. The police and the fire department had a competition to see who could knit the most socks and scarves for soldiers at the front. The citizens were all in. They tried to stop the use of wheat flour in Hawaii, and they went to banana flour to save bread for the troops. There was an enormous amount of attempts to conserve for the war effort here, metal drives. People were really interested in helping people of all different, you know, the local ethnic groups that we have here in Hawaii. Everybody chipped in. People were joining the armed forces. It was a very spectacular time to be here. There was a lot of concern that the war might come to Hawaii's shores. There were German raiders, Imperial German Navy raiders in the Pacific. So there was a climate that just, you know, it's hard to imagine now. Also that much of the U.S. Navy had gone to the Atlantic, so we weren't this huge naval power in the Pacific. So that also made people a little nervous, and it was good to have the allies that we did that were looking out for us here.
And as I understand it, Hawaii had one of the highest rates of volunteerism during the conflict, which is really amazing considering that most of the people living in Hawaii hadn't been Americans for that long.
Right. It only for, 19 years? That many people that enlisted were first or second generation, you know, whether they were from parts of Asia or parts of Europe. You had Portuguese, Japanese, Filipino, Chinese, and people from the mainland U.S. that had moved here, all, you know, chipping in this event. If you look at some of our vintage photographs that we have up on the natatorium by the gates, you can see the soldiers lined up with flower leis and silky leis of the period. And you'll see it looks like the people I went to public school with here in Hawaii, you know. It's everybody all in.
Everywhere in the country, World War I doesn't really get as much space in the consciousness of most Americans as, say, World War II or Vietnam. Why do you think that is?
Well, Douglas MacArthur said, you know, old soldiers never die. They just slowly fade away. And we have a lot of Civil War reenactments and a lot of Revolutionary War reenactments. There are people like me that do more living history, but we also didn't have the battlefields here, so we don't have the huge battlefield monuments of the Civil War or the Revolutionary War. World War II, we still have living veterans with us. People my age and people of every age grew up with probably somebody around them that went to war in World War II. I knew a few World War I veterans. My Uncle Al worked as an aviation mechanic in World War I, fixing Sopwith Camels and Spads. And they used to make the mechanics fly in the aircraft to make sure it was fixed correctly. But some of these planes were one-seaters, so you either sat on the pilot's lap or on the wing of the plane. And this was such a terror to him, he never set foot in a plane after 1919. And he passed away in the 1980s. So you can see the experiences of war, and you would think, oh, a mechanic, that's a safe job. He never got it. But that experience so traumatized him, he didn't. Another of my great uncles, Hugh Manchester, he has a Facebook site if you look. He was killed in one of the engagements leading up to the Second Battle of the Marne, one of the last battles that ended the war. And his side of my family still have flowers put on his grave every year on his birthday and the day of his death, and sometimes Memorial Day. And there's services at the World War I cemeteries in Europe that will do this for Americans. And in Europe, in the Netherlands and Belgium and France, school children go and decorate the graves of American soldiers near the battlefields there. So it's one that it's not completely forgotten. There are many people who still keep with it that history of that period. But it was also very, very traumatic war, trench warfare. And then you had simultaneously the Spanish influenza epidemic that ravaged the whole world. So it was a period many people even that went through it wanted to forget and get on with their lives, as so many of us as veterans do. And some of us want to commemorate the sacrifices and go on and try to help other people understand, educate ourselves and others. I think understanding war and military service better can help us both be prepared for war, and I hope sincerely to avoid unnecessary wars in our future.
And so how important do you think ceremonies like this one are to remember the wars of the past?
I think they're very important. We've had a lot of people come up today and talk. I talked to the colonel here, Colonel Tafal, from the U.S. Army Reserve. He and I served in the same infantry battalion together. So we have a chance to have a little camaraderie and share stories and comrades that we served with. These are important for us as veterans, as individuals. I've gotten the chance to talk to many people here and share some of the histories that I've learned from our task force historian and others, and they're times to, this is a smaller ceremony, so it's focused on this plaque unveiling. There's a very big ceremony that we're going to have on November 11th, and really encourage everybody to come out for it. It's a chance, I think, when you come to these events, particularly the big events like the one on November 11th, for parents to talk to their children and for veterans to talk to their family members about things they might not normally talk about. I go to some of my friends' family parties, and their fathers or mothers or grandparents will talk to me about things, because I'm a combat veteran, that my friends never knew at all, because they feel I'll understand or they feel a sense of camaraderie with me. And my friends will always say, oh, talk to my dad. We don't know anything about what he did during the war. And they'll find out, you know, that one of my friends found out, you know, her dad was part of the military intelligence service in World War II, and that he'd volunteered, like a lot of local Japanese Nisei, to serve, and they just sent him to the intelligence course thinking he must speak Japanese, but he didn't. So he told the guys from the mainland, well, you know how our family works. I cannot be sent back home in disgrace. So all of the Nisei guys from the mainland who were in internment camps sat there all night long after they studied and taught him Japanese. You know, and these are things that come out when veterans start to talk about their experience. Again, his family, they knew he'd served, but really knew nothing about it. And I think these kinds of events, they can sort of be catalysts for that kind of discussion, sometimes just looking at people's faces. On the 11th, we're going to have a museum. The Hawaii Historic Arms Association and some others are going to have relics from World War I, some material objects that people can see. They're going to have people dressed up in World War I uniforms, like myself, men and women, talking about the different roles that people played. And it's a chance. We're also going to have a veteran service organizations tent, where we're going to have multiple veterans organizations. People can come talk to a veteran. Veterans can come and find about what our veterans organizations do in our communities and for our communities and for one another. And we hope maybe we get some people to join. We'll also be handing out poppies, which is the, if anyone ever heard the poem on Flanders Field, it's a very touching poem written by an officer after his chaplain died in the trenches in World War I, and he is at the gravesite seeing all the poppy flowers. So in the poppy flower has become a symbol of veterans, and particularly those that we've lost in war, because it was one of the first flowers to grow up in the trenches of World War I.
And where will the ceremony be on the 11th?
Ceremony will be right here in the Peace Park, which is between Kapi'olani Park and the Hawaii War Auditorium. So if you just go to the War Auditorium, you'll see the big tent and everything there. We're going to have check online. We're going to have parking set up on the other side of Diamond Head. I don't want to say anything because it keeps changing a little bit. And then there'll be trams to come down here if people can't find parking in the immediate area. And there'll be events from 6 a.m. in the morning to 9 o'clock at night. 6 a.m. starts with bagpipers. Around the world, bagpipers are going to be playing at sunrise to commemorate the signing of the armistice that led 5 hours later to the guns ceasing on the Western Front.
A ceremony marking the 100th anniversary of the World War I armistice again will be held this Sunday at Waikiki's War Memorial Natatorium. The event is free and open to the public and again begins with a sunrise bagpipe ceremony at 6 a.m. Find the details at hawaiiworldwar1.org and make sure you use the number 1 and not the world spelled out. It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today we check in with Aaron Perichini from the Garden Isle as it prepares to switch to mail-in voting. Morning, Alan.
Morning.
I have to say, I was a little sad after reading your article this morning.
Well, I'm a fossil. I'm so old that when I first voted, the age was still 21. And my generation, I think, does have a kind of nostalgic feel about the role of the polling place and the kind of social atmosphere that prevails there. But I have to say, the generations that have followed us don't share that view. And I think all of us have to get used to the fact that voting by mail is a better way to encourage participation, and it's what today's younger voters want. So I think we need to go along with it. It's a good system. It's going to work well. Kauai will be the test bed for the state starting in 2020. And if all goes well, which I frankly personally hope it does, then the statewide starting in the 2022 election, everyone will be voting by mail. There won't be any more regular old fashioned polling places.
So when you went to go vote yesterday, I mean, you really had that in your mind that, gosh, this will pass.
Well, actually, I was a poll worker.
Ah.
So I had mailed in my ballot a long time before. But what struck me a lot was I was the poll worker in charge of the electronic voting option, which you could choose at the polling place. And of about 1,000 people we had in Kilauea, only 4 chose to vote electronically.
Hmm.
All others chose the paper ballot. And the impending system of vote by mail will preserve that. And I think people in this era of suspect electronics prefer the option of a paper trail record, which we'll still have without any interruption in Hawaii starting in 2020.
I know when I went to the polls yesterday, I really enjoyed seeing my neighbors. And, you know, I used to wear red, white, and blue and wear a hat and, you know, to have the kids in tow. But I love how you describe in your article about, you know, everybody just coming in, the soil-stained landscapers and the construction
workers. Oh, it's a great leveler. The polling places is maybe the best leveler we have in our society right now. There were pregnant women, whole families with 3, 4, even 5 children in tow. People, most of them men, coming from grubby jobs with grubby clothes on, coming in very late in the afternoon, clearly tired, clearly having worked a very, very taxing day's work, but still wanting to participate in the voting process. I just think it's wonderful.
Yes, and I know I have adult children, and I, you know, had to text them to say, "Hey, did you vote?" You know.
there were many parents who were doing that with their adult children. There were also many spouses who were doing it with their spouses. And some of those worked and some of them didn't. But we enjoyed, I think we had the highest turnout in the state on Kauai on Election Day, and partly that's because we had a historic local election in addition to everything happening at the state and federal level. But the polling place is a place that brings the community together and I think helps hold the community together. But I think that advantage will not be lost as we shift to vote by mail. I just think it's a sign of the times, and it's where technology and where our society is going.
Well, as long as it gets our voter turnout and our voter rolls up, I'm good with that. But I'm a little sad.
That's the idea. It's all about participation. It's all about turnout.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Alan.
Sure enough.
That was Kauai's Alan Parrucchini with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
With so much on the line in this election, you'll want to keep up with every twist and turn until all the votes are counted. I'm Jonathan Capehart, host of America on the Line, and we've got you covered with the latest news, analysis, and your calls. Join me for a live national conversation Monday through Thursday from WNYC Radio.
This afternoon at 3.
Multi-award-winning slack key artist John Chiave makes a rare appearance in the Atherton Studio on December 8th. In this special concert for station supporters, he'll be accompanied by the hula of Hope Chiave. HPR members, reserve your seats before they sell out at hprtickets.org. And join us for a pre-show reception with the Chiaves and Kanikapila Sunday host, Derek Malama. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
What would life have been like if you were living in Honolulu in the 1930s and were diagnosed with leprosy or Hansen's disease? Well, that's a question at the center of a new play debuting tonight at the Manoa Valley Theater. It's called Shipment Day, named for the day that a patient would be shipped off to Kalaupapa on Molokai. The play was written by Lorenzo de Stefano, and it's the story of his cousin, Olivia Ribello, who was diagnosed with leprosy at age 18. After spending time at a hospital in Kalihi, she boarded a ship to Kalaupapa, where she stayed for the next 70 years until she died in 2006. HPR's Dave Lawrence sat down recently with the play's author, and the interview includes a dramatic reading from the play. But the playwright begins by describing the sense of fear that surrounded a diagnosis of leprosy in 1934 in Honolulu, and not only for the patient.
It also had a residual effect on families. They had to move. There was a lot of gossip, like, Olivia, you know, the daughter, have you heard? She has leprosy. And the whole family, you know, you go to the store, and the people who want to touch your money. A lot of fear involved and stigma.
Did she give you any reflections on the way that you talked to it? Is a good lead into that, how different people have different stories and interpretations of things that happened to them. And also, much like a family, will send a story down the family lines, like perhaps you'd be like, yeah, my great-great-grandfather or so-and-so did such and thing. Did she share any reflections that people had shared with her on the work of Father Damien after being in that world where perhaps the firsthand stories or memories of things got passed down that would just be enlightening or that you know?
About him?
Yeah.
Well, he's revered, you know, by pretty much everyone there. Elsewhere too, but she always spoke lovingly of his sacrifice, you know, and she cried over it, what he suffered by getting the disease. He was not particularly careful at the time. There were certainly not medications to treat this that didn't come along until the 50s, where there were some successful medications to arrest this and make it non-contagious, you know. So he gave everything for people, for strangers, you know, which is the true Christian way in the way he interpreted it. And he ran into a lot of opposition from the archdiocese here. He was becoming too famous, too much of a star.
Right.
people sent money to him, and they actually probably wanted the money here, you know, for other uses.
Did when you think about this as a personal story, and it's a very personal one for you, what were some of your discoveries that you can share with us?
Well, you know, the play consists of a dramatized version of Olivia. I knew her well, maybe as well as anyone, and I knew her for 17 years. She had a lot of relatives and friends who had their own impressions of her. Mine were based on, you know, maybe 60, 70 visits to Kalapapa over a 17-year period. She'd come to the mainland and travel with me, and we got close. You know, their mothers were sisters. My mother and her mother's mother were sisters. And so the Portuguese girls. I discovered kind of what I knew already in the process of doing the play, and now in the final week of rehearsal before we open, is that this is a superb example of an everyday woman who, I call her the Rosa Parks of leprosy. In other words, she would not get off the bus. You know, she found her line and she wouldn't cross it in terms of dignity. And she said, call me by my name. You know, my name is Olivia. I'm not my condition. I'm Olivia. And she's a beacon, you know, of strength in a world where people got pushed around a lot.
Why do you think personally it's important to tell this story today?
Well, you know, people's rights are being trodden on right now, you know, rights of self-determination and existence, pride of who you are, religious freedom, immigration issues. It's popular in some quarters to isolate and export, exterminate, whatever you want to call it, the undesirables of the world, quote unquote, you know, the people that are different. And leprosy is a mythic disease, and there's a lot of misnomers still about it. So I think Olivia's story has a lot to say about getting behind the myth, you know, getting behind the fear, and realizing that how people deal with adversity and come out the other end. I mean, she lived to be 90 years old. She traveled the world. She became an author. Her book, My Life of Exile, has been out for 30 years. It's still in print. And so though she was not a willing activist or a messenger, she became one because she wouldn't shut up about it. You know, she wouldn't be put in a position of weakness. She'd been pushed around a lot, and she's sort of the original question authority person. And so I loved her a lot, and I learned a lot from her, and hopefully I helped her along the way in her passage.
Well, as you are sharing her story, you're going to do it in a pretty remarkable way today. You've got Ku'ule Shafi, who is the lead actress in your production here, and you've brought her in, she plays Olivia, and you brought her in today to reenact a scene for us. So if you can, set up what we're going to hear.
Okay. Well, I'll say that Ku'ule met Olivia when she was 9 years old here in Honolulu, which is very interesting, and that these many years later, that she went to, born on Maui, went to L.A. to become a trained actor, lives and works there now. I kind of wrote the play for her. We've known each other a long time. And for her to now be interpreting this life of a woman she met as a child and has now come to understand in a different way, this monologue is a short 2-minute extract from the play, from different aspects of the play, but that will give your listeners, I hope, a good idea of Olivia's dilemma, her life before, during, and a little bit after the diagnosis in October of 1934.
It's Ku'ule Shafi and an excerpt from Shipment Day, original work by Hawaii playwright Lorenzo DiStefano.
I used to dream. I used to think I was special. I'm Olivia Ribello. I was born 21 years ago on June 6, 1916, in Kalaheo, Koloa, Kauai, in the territory of Hawaii. When I was about 7, we moved to Oahu. It's been fun growing up in Kalihi, near the busiest downtown in the North Pacific. The streets are filled with trolleys and buses and cars and more people than I've seen in one place in my whole life. It's like something out of a Hollywood movie, full of sights and sounds and extras from almost every country in the world. Our neighbors are Hawaiian, Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino. Different as we are from each other, we all live together on this floating island. They're all poor, just like us. It's not like anybody's starving or anything, but there are times when things can get pretty tough. Until 2.5 years ago, during the first week of October 1934, my life was ordinary and uneventful. That's when Mama and I took the bus downtown to see our family doctor. When Dr. Wason came in, he looked at a blemish midway up my right arm and asked me to roll my sleeve up a little higher. While he was examining it, he asked how long I'd had it. I told him about 2 weeks. Mama said we'd been coating it with red dirt from our front yard to stop the itching. That's when he unwrapped a brand new razor blade and said, "I'm just going to take a little sample for the laboratory to check out." When I asked him what for, he said it was just a precaution, that there were some things floating around right now, but that it was probably nothing to worry about. Just a mosquito bite gone bad. We returned home and reported to my father that all was well. Less than a week later, a man showed up at our house. "Is this the home of Olivia Ribello?" "Who wants to know?" my father asked. The man handed him a piece of paper. "By order of the Board of Health, I'm here to take her away right now." "Take me where?" "To Kalihi Hospital." "But why do I have to go there?" "Because you have leprosy." All my hopes for a normal life ended in that moment. My whole world had suddenly changed. Even if I lived another 1,000 years, nothing would ever be the same for me again.
It's Ku'ule Shafi, who plays the lead role of Olivia in Shipment Day by Hawaii playwright Lorenzo DiStefano, set in Honolulu between 1934 and 1937, and dramatizing the early life experiences of DiStefano's cousin, leprosy activist Olivia Ribello.
That play opens tonight at the Manoa Valley Theater and goes until November 25th. The world premiere of Shipment Day, an original work by Hawaii's Lorenzo DiStefano, is part of Manoa Valley Theater's 50th anniversary season. Hanaho. In today's Backyard Quiz, we delved into Hawaii's opera history. One of the earliest performances was in 1854. There's an old playbill in the Hawaii State Archives that documents Donizetti's The Daughter of the Regiment, which was staged on February 11th in the Variety Theater. The royal family was said to be opera aficionados, and there's even a story about Queen Emma singing in the chorus of Verdi's Trovatore, while her husband, King Kamehameha IV, took on the role of stage manager. The dramatic art enjoyed sporadic stretches of popularity throughout the decades, but support wasn't consistent from year to year. C.J. Walker, who wrote about the local opera scene in the mid-20th century, had this to say, "Opera in Honolulu has been like Hawaii's volcanoes. Historically, it has burst into brilliant displays and then lapsed into periods of sleep." However, by 1960, the Hawaii Opera Theater, the state's only major opera company, was established. A year later, the organization staged its very first production, Puccini's Madame Butterfly, performed in the McKinley High School Auditorium. And that was the answer we were looking for, but no one got it right. That is today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Stoke. That's the title of a film set against a dramatic backdrop of Kilauea Volcano. The film debuts at the International Film Festival this weekend. Take a listen to a clip.
"So I bet this was more than you bargained for. Did you really hire them to take you to the lava?"
"Yeah, I really did."
"It's ridiculous, no offense, how people show up to see it."
"Is it?"
"Yeah, it is.
So many people, thousands and thousands, flying from God knows where to see a damn volcano before they can understand that the land is the law. We're not really in control of anything.
Are you okay?
Yeah. It's just a dish, right?
That was a clip from the film Stoke. Zoe Eisenberg is the filmmaker. She talked with us about the making of that movie, which she calls a love letter to a place she now calls home.
Stoke is about a tourist who comes to Hawaii to visit the Kilauea volcano. She hires two wannabe tour guides, a pair of locals, to take her there, and the story is really about their journey of getting from A to B.
And you managed to get some of these scenes on film when the lava is really pumping over there.
Yeah, so we shot the film around the 2016-2017 lava hose. I'm not sure if you remember, but it was dumping 40 feet of lava right into the coast off Kalapana. So as you can imagine, it was very hard to plan a production when the critical element could stop or shift or move at any time. So we were forced to change along with it and just figure out a way for our production to be safe and respectful while also getting what we needed, which I think is really interesting because our production was, in a way, a mini representation of the story we were trying to tell. So Phillips Payson, who's my co-director and just my co-creator, we do everything together. We both live in Pune, and we first came up with the idea for Stoke while finishing a documentary called Aloha from Lava Land, which chronicles our town's reaction to the 2014 flow that happened in Pahoa. So we were going around conducting dozens of interviews for Aloha from Lava Land, and we kept meeting people who came here, who moved here, or were here visiting specifically because of the volcano, and they all had these stories about coming here to be healed or to be humbled or what they've learned from living so close to the volcano. So that just sparked the idea for Stoke, and we really wanted to tell a story that addressed lava tourism from both sides, the perspective of the people who come here and the perspective of the people who are born here and what they think about. I've heard them called the lava lookies, the people who come just to kind of see what it's all about.
And you managed to show this film to some of the folks that live in that area. What was the response like?
We did. We had a test screening for the people. It was kind of a joint function. We showed the film to people who worked on it here, and we also invited a lot of people who were impacted by the most recent flow, and many of them had lost their homes. And we were nervous as to what their reaction would be, but overall they were really moved to see a story that mirrors their own experience, and also a lot of the locations that we shot the film at are now covered under 40 feet of lava. So it was really healing in a lot of ways for them to be able to see those places captured.
And I imagine as a filmmaker, you know, you want experiences that ring true. I'm sure the parallels were just amazing with the, you know, knowing what that community is going through right now.
Right. So in the film, our characters walk through a lava field, a Kalapana lava field that was once a thriving neighborhood and is now covered in lava. And by doing so, they explore, like you said earlier, adaptation and the idea of community resilience. So it was sort of ironic for that to be a strong theme of the film and then have lava from the same volcano take out a large neighborhood only. I mean, it was, what, 15 months after we shot that the eruption started.
When you're there at home in Pune and you see what that community is going through now, you know, what do you think about?
Well, I love living here. It's a challenging place to live. Living in a place that's still forming makes me realize that I'm small and that my time here is fleeting and that the earth is going to continue doing its thing with or without me. And I think this is a concept that can be heard easy enough, but it's hard to actually understand it and, you know, to understand that change is really the only constant. And I think living near a volcano makes you understand that. And I think that's why this is such a special place for people to live.
And so tell us about the title of the film.
Sure. Stoke, as in to stoke a fire. So a lot of our characters in the film are dealing with some sort of change, some sort of fiery change, and that's sort of where the title came from.
And you also made an effort to cast authentic voices,
yes.
Actors.
Yeah, it was very important for us to cast our Hawaiian characters authentically, just because in the past, you know, big Hollywood productions tend to whitewash their characters. Even my first film that I shot here, I shot it right after I moved here. It's called Thruple. And because I didn't have any connections here, I cast all characters from New York City. So I had no authentic representation at all in the film. And as I became more invested in the community here and really come to understand the community, I really regretted that. So for Stoke, it was important for us to cast our Hawaiian characters authentically. And we spent around 6 months looking for the right actors who were talented but also identified with the story and with Hawaiian heritage. So the film is going to be played all over the state of Hawaii. Hawaii is our main target audience. It's really a love letter to Big Island, so we want the people in Hawaii to be able to see it. So we're playing with HIF on Oahu on November 10th and 11th, and then on Big Island December 2nd. And then after that premiere, we're going to be traveling across the state. We're going to be playing again on Oahu, again on Hawaii Island in several different theaters, and then over on Kauai.
All right. And then as far as any other festivals?
We were accepted into the Austin Indie Fest, which is actually happening the same weekend as HIF in Austin, Texas, which is great. And then we've submitted to many other festivals but haven't heard back yet.
Okay. Well, you're going to be busy.
Yeah, very busy.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sitting down with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to filmmaker Zoe Eisenberg. The film Stoke screens at the 38th Annual Hawaii International Film Festival, presented by Halekulani, Saturday and Sunday at the Regal Theater at Dokanere here on Oahu. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk multi-generational housing and more. The American Institute of Architects Honolulu chapter shares its take on good design amidst the housing crisis and the industry push to meet the demand for inventory. And it wants your input. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Record your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.